Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back, and at least half of us remained a Movie Buff Specialist over the course of the last week, although we know a lot of you have probably jumped ship because of the name that is on John's picture right there, where it says number 54, The Last Jedi. That's right. Today we are talking about The Rules of the Game by Jean Renoir and The Last Jedi by Rian Johnson, arguably. And John, we're obviously going to talk about this one last, so you're going to have to wait. But
of course.
Arguably the most polarizing movie in the history of movies?
I'd say it's definitely up there. Critical response for this movie was pretty high when it came out, but the general population was pretty low on it. It's gained a lot of fans over the years now, and a lot of people have come around to it. But yeah, it's going to be fun to discuss that kind of journey that this movie took since its release in 2017.
Yeah, and then we have an old movie in The Rules of the Game, which came out in 1939, which is an interesting one for me because Renoir is very popular amongst cinephiles, film fanatics, whatever you want with this and Grand Illusion, and I guess you could even throw A Day in the Country in there, but also not really a household name the way that like some of these other French directors who came more during the French New Wave were able to become a household name. And definitely, you know, 1939, that's not exactly the other day. That's for sure. I think we've only talked about maybe one or two movies as old or older than this one. But that's what we're gonna be talking about rather than Parasite, because I chose the reason why I chose The Rules of the Game, even though they're not really all that close in terms of tone or anything like that. I thought The Rules of the Game was very interesting at showing a non-American rich lifestyle and people who don't really necessarily belong in that lifestyle and other people who were just born into it and all of the interactions between the wealthy and the poor and things like that in this massive mansion where all of the chaos takes place. So I thought it was like an interesting look, and one's made 1939. The other one comes out in 2019, completely different eras. However, some things just never change, and that some people are poor and some people are rich. And that's something that really just continues to stand the test of the time. And why I think The Rules of the Game, while ultimately not my favorite and nowhere really close to my top 100, is still a very interesting watch. You know, all these, 83 years later at this point, I think it still holds up for the most part.
Yeah, it's definitely a movie that, because of the topic it's exploring and satirizing, it's always going to be relevant as long as we live in a society like we do, where there are rich people, there are poor people. And a lot of the satire can be missed watching this movie nowadays, because you kind of have to realize what the satire is going for. But overall, the film is always going to have a place no matter when you watch it.
Yeah. And I think that's the hardest part about comedy and why comedies generally don't hold up as well as dramas. So, you know, one of those things is like people always, Oscars are always going to dramas and awards always go to dramas. And a lot of the best revered actors, directors of all time are normally dramatic actors. You always have the breakthroughs like Chaplin and Buster Keaton. And then you'll have, Cary Grant, who pretty much made an entire career on being a comedian. However, even when you watch some of those movies, you watch Bringing Up Baby, some of it just totally misses now. And Bringing Up Baby is definitely a movie that I find to be completely overrated. I just recently rewatched, actually this last week, Sullivan's Travels, which is a Preston Sturges movie with Veronica Lake, really Veronica Lake's only really big role until Kim Basinger plays her in L.A. Confidential. But really, like, the big thing, it's a comedy and it works for the most part. However, it's still a very dated comedy because it came out in 41, I believe. That still makes it dated. Comedies are so hard to keep relevant. And that's actually why I think people like Chaplin and Keaton continue to survive, because pantomime actually can survive this. Dialogue becomes hard because what the hell are you talking about? Whereas Charlie Chaplin in City Lights getting pushed into the river 15 times over and over again, yeah, we're going to say, okay, they probably should have learned the rule of threes at this point. However, yeah, it's still going to have the same type of effect because it's just physical comedy. Rules of the Game is a very, very dialogue-heavy movie. Now, there's some great, great visual humor in this movie, but it is a very dialogue-heavy movie. And because of that, I do feel that It has lost its touch a little bit, mainly in the first hour. Now, the last 45 minutes of this movie, I think, might be the arguably the best 45 minutes of a comedy ever. I think it is so incredibly well done, but the first hour just does nothing for me because, again, I think I just don't get it. I think it goes over my head. I'm not French. I was never told about 1930s French history. I know that they were, you know, in war, and I know what happened, but this doesn't do anything for me because I don't really understand the class dynamic here the way you might during like a French Revolution type piece where it's something that really made its way into America. 1930s France, we don't talk about that in America.
Well, you know where we do talk about it? We talk about it in Canada. So
well,
I
that's because you're French.
No, I'm not French, but we do have French people living in Canada, yes. And when it comes to like this 1930s culture and everything, I do think this is kind of where the rules of the game kind of loses its falter. This is a movie that is often considered one of the best ever made. Ever. I believe it's sitting on the British Film Institute's top 100 at number 4 currently. Behind Vertigo, Citizen Kane, and Tokyo Story.
Oh, so and BFI. See, what's funny is BFI actually does it, even though they're British Film Institute. They do every single country.
They do. They do. But
yeah, they have it at number 4.
Yeah. So, like, this is often cited along with the likes of Citizen Kane as one of the greatest movies of all time. And when I was watching it, I'm watching it. I get the satire. I get the fact that what Renoir is going for here is this idea that the French bourgeoisie are essentially the reason why World War II can happen. And like that's really the main theme that we're seeing in this movie. That's what it's satirizing, is the fact that all of this triviality of what's going on with these rich people means that people like Hitler can come to power. Now, with this movie coming out in 1939, yes, we saw the rise of the Nazi Party in Germany. This was released in July. Germany invades Poland in September. And so 2 months later, and at that point, this movie is banned in France. Because the French government says it's too influential on the young people. We need them to fight in this war and not decide not to because they don't like these rich people. And it stayed banned. And during World War II, the original negatives for this film were destroyed. And we didn't get a restoration of the film intact, approved by Renoir, until 1968. And at that time, that is when this film blew up and everyone started raving about this film. I personally feel that if World War II had not happened exactly as it did from that point, we would not be talking about this film as this powerhouse of cinema that we talk about it now.
Yeah, and a reason why I wanted to bring this one up is the first time I watched it, I thought it was good. I didn't love it. And the second time I watched it, I kind of had the same feeling on it, like where it's a good movie. I definitely appreciate it. And like I said, the last 45 minutes to me are just impeccable. Like them running around and everybody sleeping with each other, trying to sleep with each other and trying to kill each other. And one of my favorite scenes is when they're beating each other up on one side of the room, and the woman is sitting there drinking and watching like in awe while the people on the other side of her beating each other up. Like that is so forward thinking. That is what we see. That's the type of humor that we do see nowadays, where it's almost like, oh, there they go. Like we see that in the 2000s, 2010s. And this came out in 1939. One of the main reasons why, and I'm looking at this BFI list and based on the AFI list, one of the reasons why I think this movie stands out so much is because of how distinctly French it is and how Renoir very much is able to grasp like what being French. And like I said, I don't have much of an understanding of this, but what being French at that time is like. And when you look at a lot of these BFI movies, Tokyo Story at number 3, you have The Searchers at number 7, you have Man with a Movie Camera at number 8. 8.5 at number 10. These are movies that are very distinct to the country that made them. And I think that's what can make it stand out, because a movie like The Searchers, whether you find it incredibly boring, which I know, John, we talked about this and you didn't like you. This was one that you didn't really like all that much.
I enjoyed it. I acknowledge it as a good movie, but I didn't get all the hubbub about it.
And I think like what it is with a lot of these movies is they just so impactful to what this way of life is. Like even me, I grew up in the Northeast of America. I grew up in the United States of America. I didn't grow up in Nova Scotia, but I grew up in the Northeast, which I guess would be the Southeast for you. So what am I doing? But I grew up in the Northeast of the United States. The Searchers was the closest I got to the Western until I drove across the country to Los Angeles. That's crazy to think about. You get nothing like any of that until you actually leave. My dad, this is one of his favorite movies of all time. He never went to Los Angeles until I moved there. He never been to Arizona. He'd been to San Antonio, which I guess, you know, has like a bit of, but the thing is, these movies are so distinct. People in France who have never been to La Cornier or whatever the hell this thing is called. I probably just insulted people in French because of my whatever I just said. But wherever they're going here, even if you haven't been there, if you're French, you're probably seeing something here and being like, wow, that is so much what, like, that's still relevant to French society today. The rich and these, you know, I mean, you think about it. The French are always known for like free love and all of that stuff. Everybody sleeps with everybody. I mean, every American movie you see that has French people in it is they're the ones who are just, they have eight different girlfriends and all that stuff. But this movie was drawing on that in 1939 to show just how much a part of the culture that is. And talking about how Muslims have know everything that's going on and have it right because they have a wife and all their girlfriends. Why should they cut everybody out? Like, I just think like those types of things are so still relevant to the culture. That's why a movie like The Rules of the Game still holds up. It's still very funny too, which also really helps, because a movie like The Bicycle Thieves, which I understand is Scorsese's favorite movie or whatever you want to say, that movie is brutal because it's miserably depressing. It's not funny at all. And you really have to be Italian to really appreciate every single thing that's going on there. That's a movie that I'm just like, nah, I'm good. I could never watch that again and be totally happy for the rest of my life.
Yeah. And you raise a very good point, especially when we're looking at just some of these like French cultures as presented in this film. And it is of its time too, because the only reason that the triviality of what these people are doing is satire is because of that movement towards socialism throughout Europe in the 30s with, you know, the rising of the Nazi party and everything. So when we look at that and we get something like the hunting scene, which is just so foreign to a lot of people.
Didn't get it at all. That's one of the scenes where I'm like, all right, fast forward and I'll just move on to everything else.
It's also a ridiculously long scene in a movie with not ridiculously long scenes. And it's kind of your only reprieve from talking in the entire movie as well. Like you've already mentioned, it's a very dialogue heavy movie, yet we get this like 10 minute hunting scene in the middle of it that there's no dialogue at all in.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because I also think that's kind of a turning point of the movie, because I too felt like the beginning half of the movie is kind of like, okay, whatever, they're rich people. Yeah. And it gets funnier from this hunting scene when things start falling apart. But it's the fact that we don't have to relate to the fact that these are rich people. We can watch this movie and be like, man, I really don't like rich people. And it still connects you to the movie, because despite the fact that like a lot of these characters are not very interesting because they're just people who are so removed from the rest of the world around them that you can still watch them to see, okay, but where's this going to go? Because we know that all these people are in these relationships with each other and are in love with each other and everything. And we have a French nationalist hero who crossed the Atlantic in, what was it, 13 hours, which is very impressive back then. And he doesn't care about it. All he cares about is the fact that the girl didn't show up.
Yeah.
And like, it's that aspect of this movie that kind of shows that these people are just so removed from everything else happening in the world around them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I think that some of that, like, being removed is kind of funny because at the beginning, it's clearly stated on the dawn of World War II. So they know it's common and all that. And it says on the dawn of World War II, and then it makes this movie about nonsense. And I also think, like, you know, that's why I love a movie like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood or Everybody Wants Some or something like that, where it's these movies that are about the buildup to the event. They're so worried about who's sleeping with who, who's going to kill who, blah, 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 blah. And there's a war that's about to be fought because they're not focused on it at all. However, there's something, I don't know what the right word is, but there's almost something admirable about how they're all acting. There's something so normal about it. And I think that that's something that, you know, could be relevant to today as we go through this whole pandemic thing, which, John, it's been going on for longer than our podcast.
Yep.
It's one of those things where it's like, there's something to be said about, like, not living in fear of the unknown, even though you kind of know it's there. And that's what's happening in this movie. I think that they're all so blatantly removed from everything, but it is still a driving force of the conversation early on that, hey, what's going on with this? Or, you know, the way they talk about Jewish people in this movie. I mean, you know, they're not calling them the nicest things in this movie. And, you know, talking about how all of this is going on, it does create this idea of, like, they know, but really it's the poorer people who are talking about it more than anything, but they know it's coming. They just, they're not going to let themselves be deterred from almost their basic human needs and basic human wants. And that's what they're more focused on this entire movie. And maybe those are the rules of the game. I don't know. Maybe that's, like, what the rule is. When you're a human, you're just more worried about your basic wants and needs than anything else.
Well, I mean, the rules of the game that they're talking about is more like the nobility of it all, right? Where it's like, it's okay to be going around and cheating with everyone, but you can't run off with them.
Yeah.
Right? We get that reference at one point in the
letter. Yeah, no, you definitely do. I'm more saying maybe there's, like, that underlying thing of, like, there's this, but it's also this. There's this idea that, like, you don't have to worry. Like, you're human. Worry about what's in front of you, not what's out there in the grand scheme that's going to weigh down. At the end of the day, every single one of us is going to die, but you try not to think about that all of the time. Otherwise, life is absolutely miserable because all you're doing is wondering, why am I here? That's not a great way to go through things. And I think that that's part of, you know, this movie is, like, they're still so, like, he's Jean Renoir's character, Octave or whatever they call him, is so excited that he's going to get Christine at the end of the movie. And, like, that's what he's so focused on, despite the fact they know she's sleeping with everybody and blah, blah, blah. And he's not worried about anything else that's going on outside of this because he's finally getting the thing that he wants.
But that in itself is the critique that Renoir is putting forward in the film too, right? Where it's like, the problem is that is how these people are acting. Because the fact that they're so self-absorbed and they're so focused on, they're never focused on what's best for anyone else. Everyone in this movie is inherently selfish. Every single one of them. And that's what Renoir is really saying, is that, hey, if you weren't so selfish, these bad things like World War II might not have happened. Yeah. And it's reflected best, I believe, in the staff and the servants of the hunting lodge, because what it comes down to is when we first see them, they're all making fun of the wealthier people. They're making fun of them and the way they're acting. But then as we progress through the film, they start mimicking the exact same behaviors. Exactly. And that's where that critique comes in, where Renoir is like, if you continue to act like this, everyone else is going to act like this too, and then nothing's going to happen.
Yeah. Well, and that's where I almost chose Gosford Park as my movie for this. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but I didn't want to go Robert Altman, because I had The Long Goodbye just a couple weeks ago. And the fact that I don't have any Robert Altman actually in my top 100, then turn around and be like, and now here's two Robert Altmans in 6 weeks. I just felt was weird. But that's also a movie that is literally about the people at the party and the people preparing for the party.
Yeah,
and that one focuses even more on the people preparing for the party. You know that somebody dies in that movie, and you know that that's what's coming, but that is so backseat to what's actually taking place in the movie. Yeah. Very much like the rules of the game. The death in this movie almost means nothing. I mean, even at the, oh, it was an accident, Andre Giroux is dead. They just kind of, like, move on from it. They don't even seem all that upset, because it's like, well, the hero had to die. Like, you know, but also, I mean, is that more of too, like, you know, while all the people who actually belong in this society, all of the really rich people, they're getting to continue to live like that. And the heroes, whatever you want to call it, going out to fight the war, the ones who are going to end up dying and getting shot anyway. I mean, that's really where Andre Giroux, he's the hero of France, but he's the one who gets killed while everybody else just gets to continue going on. It happened. We'll move on and we'll have another party tomorrow.
Yeah. I mean, that's a really great investigation into this, because it's the fact that it's Andre who dies and how he's the one who wasn't supposed to be there in the first place. Mm-hmm. He was invited because Octave was incredibly incessant on it, mm-hmm. in order to, you know, please everyone. And the fact of the matter is, he is the one who's causing a lot of this issue, mm-hmm. because he's pining after Christine and everything. And his death feels so meaningless in this movie.
Meaningless, yep.
It's just like, oh, wow, that sucks.
Yep.
Cool, I guess life goes on. And that's exactly how the characters act. No one is punished.
Nope.
Schumacher literally is just like, yeah, my bad. Just killed this national hero.
Yep.
No big deal. We're good. Just
let him go. Yep.
Yeah. And it's hits home. It really hits hard when you think about, like, this is what this wealthy elite feel of people who are not of their stature.
Mm-hmm.
They just don't care. And like we said, it echoes throughout everything. We're going to see it next week when we talk about Parasite, but again, in a more modern light, but these issues have been stemming on throughout the course of history, and Renoir just presents it in a way where it's really easy to still understand, even if you're not looking for those deeper themes in the work.
Yeah, you don't have to have a great sense of what's going on here to know what's going on here. Like, you don't have to have some deeper understanding of all of these things. And I do think, though, like, that is what ultimately is the statement of this movie. As the war is going on, these are the people least affected by it. It's the same thing. Like, when I lived in Los Angeles, all of those millionaires, they don't even realize that there's homeless people all over the place, because they never have to interact with them. But the people who are going out and about and walking around the streets, the assistants of those people, we're the ones who are living and being like, oh my God, like, what is going on here? Like, this is crazy. There needs to be something that can stop this. While the people who are at the top, they don't care that that's happening. And they'll say all the right things. But at the end of the day, as long as they're not bothering them, the second that one of them bothers them, oh my God, to get them away from, like, it's so crazy. And so that's pretty much what this movie's doing. Like, Andre Giroux never has a chance the entire time. Mm-hmm. Never has a chance. And, you know, it's rightful that he gets shot at the end, that it's not Octave who gets shot at the end. Mm-hmm. Because if it was him, it would be like, well, why did he die? He didn't deserve to die. Like, over a mistaken identity, it should be Andre Giroux who gets killed over mistaken identity. And the mistaken identity ultimately is that he's a hero. He's not really a hero. Like, that's the thing too. Glamorizing certain events and making heroes out of people who are just doing things that, like, yeah, back in the day, that was cool, but that doesn't mean he's a good person by any means. He's still a baby, like they're saying. Mm-hmm. Making a hero and trying to force people to be heroes by making them going and fighting in wars and everything, and they get killed, and it's like, you know, it's the whole BoJack Horseman, thoughts and prayers, moving on. Like, that's it. That's how it feels. And, you know, it gets scathing, but Renoir does it in such a way that it never really feels depressing. Like, it still feels, still feels like a comedy from start to finish in this movie, despite the fact that it does start to get to these really, really deep themes near the end.
Yeah, and that's really what impresses me the most with this film, is that despite the fact that it does get really heavy, it's still presented in that manner that keeps it light, keeps the satire going, so that when we do see, and we finally get that idea, like Andre Giroux getting to the point where he's gonna kill him once. This is literally what the movie set up for, and then he gets shot. And the fact that it's so unimpactful that he gets shot there, it's crazy, because Christine literally goes from deciding to want to be with Andre Giroux to then being like, no, Octave, we're running off together now.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's wild that this is what is so frivolous and so ridiculous about these characters in this movie. And yeah. Renoir just captures it so well.
Yeah, he does a really good job. I've never actually seen Grand Illusion. It's one that's on my list, and I definitely want to get around to. I know it's like, oh, another one that's always discussed as being, you know, up there and everything like that. I do think Rules of the Game, while I gave it 3 stars out of 4, I definitely think it's a movie that's worth a look. Have some patience early on, but by the time you get into the real fun games of the second half, it just flies, man. Like it just goes, and you know, it does such a good job of balancing all of the excitement and the anger and the heavier moments and the light moments and all of that. And everybody's just trying to sleep with everybody. And it's just like, mm-hmm. that is something that, like, you know, another movie, and I've talked about it a lot with the Bergman movie, but like Smiles of a Summer Night, very similar to the Rules of the Game, except it's really only the rich. There's really nothing with the poor in that, but very similar where like they just all are together and it's everybody wants to sleep with everybody. Like, those, there's something so funny about those kinds of movies when they're done really, really well, when they're not done in just like the corny rom-com kind of way. Really, nobody gets their moment at the end of this. Nobody ends up walking out of this happy. They're all still going to be pining for whoever it was that they were pining for. And here they are. Here we are. Like, that's how it ends. But it somehow feels satisfying despite all that. And like I said, the last 45 minutes of this movie, just pure perfection. I just don't get the first hour mm-hmm. the way I wish I did.
Yeah, and the fact that the movie ends the way it is, where things go really bad when they decide to break the rules of the game, mm-hmm. the metaphorical rules of the game.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, that's when someone dies, and then they all go back to their station. They all go back to the way that it was before to not upset the status quo. But you know every single one of them still could be cheating on their spouses and sleeping with whoever they want to, but they're just going to follow the rules again.
Yeah. Exactly. They're just going to go right back to where everything started from. And that's what kind of makes it fun. Fun fact, the lady who played Lisette, Paulette Dubois, or Dubois, I have no idea. She lived to be 100, almost 101, was 2 weeks away from turning 101 years old. That's pretty crazy.
That is.
I just wanted to throw that one out there as a little fun fact. But anything else you want to say about the Rules of the Game? I know it's not the movie that we actually had on our list. It's a movie that is filling in for Parasite, which we're going to talk about next week. We almost put it at the exact same spot. But is there anything else?
No. I think I've covered everything I want to talk about with it.
All right. What was the best movie you watched over like the last couple weeks? Because last week we did our 2021 year in review. So it's been a little bit since I think we've actually, or I guess we, well, because we didn't talk about what was
no,
the best
thing. No, we didn't talk about it last week. No.
So I guess what was the best thing that you've watched since we got together and discussed? Now I actually have to relook at mine.
It was actually the movie I watched right after we stopped our year in review podcast last week. I watched Portrait of a Lady on Fire. Finally, I've been meaning to watch it for a very long time. And boy, is that a beautiful film. Mm. Every aspect of it was incredible. The acting's phenomenal, the emotion attached to the film. But what really stood out for me is that every single shot is framed like a portrait of some sort. Mm. And it's just such a, the cinematography of that film is absolutely gorgeous. If you want to sit down and watch a 2-hour French movie, please do. It's absolutely incredible. It's on Canopy. It's a great watch.
Yeah, I definitely have to check that one out. That one's always up there for pretty much everybody. So I really need to get on that. I realized that our last podcast that we did this was December 22nd. So I have to go from anything past there, which would mean that my best movie is Scrooge from 1951. Mm-hmm. Which is the Alistair Sim Christmas Carol. But I think I kind of brought that one up a little bit. But that is just, that's the best one. It's not even close. It just captures everything. It's short, quick, to the point. Alistair Sim is the only Scrooge. He's the only one who can actually pull it off. He's absolutely freaking phenomenal. He's one of the best actors ever. And he's in like 2 movies that I've seen in my entire life. However, we'll move past that one. I already talked a lot about Licorice Pizza. Spy Who Loved Me, I actually finished watching after I was half drunk the one night when I started it. Still a 4-star movie, still the best Bond. It's absolutely amazing. So I'll go, though, with one that I actually watched for the first time, and that was Elizabeth. And I actually watched that last night with Cate Blanchett, Jeffrey Rush, Christopher Eccleston, which I was really pumped to see him in this role because I love him so much in The Leftovers, and he's not really in that many movies. Joseph Fiennes, who, by the way, in 1998 was pretty much the heartthrob of all heartthrobs, and then he just vanished. His career lasted exactly from 1998's Oscars to the end of 1998's Oscars. That was literally it. Because he was in Elizabeth and Shakespeare in Love the same year. You can say what you want about those two movies, but it's pretty crazy that Joseph Fiennes is in both of those and then just literally does nothing the rest of his career.
That's not true, because I watched a Joseph Fiennes movie last week.
What'd you watch?
I watched Enemy at the Gates.
Oh, yeah, dude. That was such a hit. What a great movie. Anyway, but I pretty much read the Wikipedia afterwards of all the mistakes in the movie from a historical sense. And I have to say that nothing really makes me more mad than when people rip on a movie for historical senses that are wrong with it. Because, like, screw you. They're not making a documentary. They're making a freaking movie. Who the hell gives a shit? So many things in there are just, like, so nitpicky and stuff. The man made an epic, very, very entertaining movie. Let's leave it at that. Okay, it's a very entertaining movie by Kapoor. It's very, very good. Cate Blanchett is great. Gwyneth Paltrow still deserves her Oscar. Yeah, there's my middle finger to everybody here. Gwyneth Paltrow deserved the Oscar. Cate Blanchett's very good, though. This movie has everybody in it. Kelly MacDonald's in it. Alfie Allen is even in it for a very brief moment as, like, a child, which is really funny. Daniel Craig is in it. Emily Mortimer's in it. Vincent Cassell's in it. It just goes on and on and on. Very entertaining, very fast-paced. Nothing like Queen Margot, doesn't get there, even though it kind of is bracing for similar subjects here. Anjou, the Duke of Anjou, is in this. However, you know, it's no Queen Margot. Let's just put it at that. But still a very good movie, and one that I've been meaning to watch for a really long time, and it did not disappoint. It kind of did exactly what I wanted it to. Also, Richard Attenborough is in it, too. Got to throw that in. Can't forget Richard Attenborough. All right, let's talk about The Last Jedi, which I think everybody agrees, at least on this podcast, is worse than The Rise of Skywalker. John, I'm here to just take one last dig before you try to sit here and convince me. John, I never saw The Rise of Skywalker because The Last Jedi kind of turned me off from it. Although, let's be real, Solo turned me off from everything. But anyway, give me your take here. It's number 54. You keep saying you're going to go higher with it. I got to say, before you get going here, I don't necessarily not see the appeal anymore. So let's go. Let's hear it.
So, controversial take. The Last Jedi is the best Star Wars movie. Or should I say, it's the best movie that takes place in the Star Wars universe. Because from the film standpoint, it's the best constructed film out of any of the Star Wars movies. It's more complex than A New Hope, which is just that hero's journey. And when we talked about Empire Strikes Back, we had already talked about how it's just expanding that hero's journey to go a little bit further and kind of rehash it over two more movies. But what The Last Jedi does, and what I believe Rian Johnson does absolutely better than any other director in all of the Star Wars films, I would say Star Wars properties, but Jon Favreau is doing a phenomenal job with his series. And what we're, and as of course, why can I not remember his name? The one who does all the animated series as well.
That I couldn't tell you.
Just drawing a blank there. But what Rian Johnson does with The Last Jedi is realize the potential of Star Wars. Because what we have before this, and this is really what I think a lot of people, why a lot of people dislike this movie, is because when this movie came out, they were expecting a Star Wars movie. Dave Filoni, thank you.
There you go. Everybody.
Both Jordan and Pat Sox.
You ready for this?
Thank you so much.
First time I ever heard his name in my life. Continue.
But we have to look at the atmosphere of where the world was at when The Last Jedi came out. The Force Awakens had come out 2 years previous, and everyone was raving about it. That is a movie that has not stood up to the test of time. A lot of people acknowledge the fact that it's just a rehashing of A New Hope. But it captured the feel of Star Wars. And that's what people were looking for in 2015. Then in 2016, we have Rogue One, which I think is the most overrated Star Wars movie of
all time. Yeah, I don't like that movie at all.
Such
a pointless, like, why did we watch that? But continue.
Yes. But everyone who watched that loved it for some reason. And they loved the fact it felt like a Star Wars movie. And that is what everyone kind of had a complaint about when it came to The Last Jedi, was that it didn't feel like a Star Wars movie. But that's because Rian Johnson was trying to evolve the Star Wars franchise. We had Star Wars had kind of grown stagnant at this point, and we saw that with The Force Awakens, where it's rehashing the same story again and again. So when Rian Johnson comes in, he starts the film almost identical to the way The Empire Strikes Back starts, with the rebels having to leave their base because they've been discovered by the Empire, or the First Order in this case. And that's kind of where most of the similarities end for the film. And this is why I think this film was much better done than the other sequel films, because it wasn't just a rehash of what we'd already seen. It was exploring this new dynamic, and it was exploring it through character. We've talked about, when we talked about Empire Strikes Back, we talked about how the characters in the Star Wars series are kind of bland. They're not very exciting characters. They're very archetypical characters who follow very specific roles and will always, beat for beat, they're pretty predictable characters. Han Solo is the cocky fly guy, but he's also this reluctant leader who steps into his leadership role. And The Force Awakens tried to do that with Poe, and Rian Johnson said, no, I'll do you one better. Poe is just a cocky fly guy who has no leadership qualities whatsoever. And this is the first thing that I think really sets The Last Jedi apart, is we get Poe's character is almost this entire movie. One of the biggest critiqued parts of this entire film is the Canto Bite sequence. So the casino and everything there, and Finn and Rose's storyline. And that's because Finn and Rose aren't actually the reason that storyline's happening. That storyline is all there to set up Poe's character and how terrible he is at foresight.
Yes, I just wish they would have done it in a much shorter way and got Rose. See, okay. Here's my thing. First 45 minutes of this movie, I was like, well, shit, John was right. Like, this sucks. Like, I'm going to have to go on here. I've been talking shit about this movie so much, and now I have to, like, talk about how good it was. I was really concerned. I really, really, really was concerned that I was going to like it a lot more. And then we had floating Leia. And I remember being in the movie theater and that scene happening, going, what is this? And then as I was watching it this time, I was like, wow, I totally had forgotten about that. Like, you know, suppressing bad memories. And all of a sudden I was like, oh God, that's right. I really hated this. But I'm like, okay, don't let that ruin it. Like, let's see what happens here. Like, let's see if you can get it back. And then for pretty much the rest of the movie, while I do agree that it's entertaining, my biggest complaints are this. One, Rose and Finn storyline stinks. And I get that this is to show Poe. Like, this is Poe's idea. And I get that. The problem is I don't care about Poe. And I really didn't care about Poe in The Force Awakens, despite how much I like The Force Awakens. I just never care about Poe at all. I feel like Poe is such a cop-out of, like, we really wanted to make Oscar Isaac, like, in this movie, because you guys have heard of Oscar Isaac. I think what's unfortunate is the beauty of the original Star Wars, you had heard of none of them. And that's what made it so good. Why did we need Oscar Isaac to come in and, like, save the movie? Wasn't having Harrison Ford and Carrie Fisher and then Mark Hamill, wasn't that going to be enough? Like, wasn't that going to be enough with The Force Awakens? Wasn't that just everything we could possibly need to make us go sit down? And I don't know, the fact that the name of the movie is Star Wars, like, isn't that going to help? And I feel like Oscar Isaac and... And it's like, that's why he's in it, because he's Oscar Isaac. And Poe, they're constantly trying to find things for Poe to do that's going to make Poe interesting. And I just never found Poe interesting. So what my biggest problem is when Poe is just not that interesting to me, and he sends Finn and Rose off, who I really don't care about their relationship. And one of my biggest problems with this movie is the ending and how it kind of makes it where, like, Rose saves Finn so that their love can be bigger than destroying the end. And I'm just like, oh my God. Like, I could feel my brain hurting and, like, my heart breaking, not for them, but for myself at watching that. That totally misses for me. That is the one part of this movie that just 100% totally misses for me. And then I will say, because I know you're gonna have a big rebuttal here, so I just wanted to throw this other part in. The other part that I just cannot get behind is how underdeveloped Snoke is. And to me, it feels like such a Darth Maul failure that I just don't care. Like, it's like they had this cool villain. They could have done more with him. And then I think they just dropped the ball on it. Maybe I'm missing it. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it was just because it was this whole Emperor versus Darth Vader thing. And now Adam Driver versus Snoke, whatever. I needed more from Snoke to be satisfied. And right now, those are two pretty big storylines for me that really just don't do it at all for me.
Okay.
Continue.
So I'll try to address these in the order you've addressed them. So, floating Leia. I understand why people think the floating Leia is weird. It's odd. It takes you out of it. But I actually think it's a very important part of Leia's character. Because one thing that we didn't really build up to, and unfortunately was touched upon in Rise of Skywalker, but not really touched upon at all, preceding that, we know Leia is a very powerful force wielder. Mm-hmm. We know that she's, you know, a Skywalker. She has this attuneness with the force based on her genetics there. And this is what a lot of the critique of Rise of Skywalker came down to, was the whole, like, why is everything in this universe revolve around this one family? But Leia is so powerful of a Jedi that she inadvertently used the force. And she's inadvertently used it before. She used it in Empire Strikes Back when she's communicating with Luke. She's used it in Return of the Jedi when she figures out Luke's her brother. And we have it here where she inadvertently protects herself in the vacuum of space, pulls herself back into the safety of the ship. Gives us one of the best foreshadowing scenes in the entire movie, where she flies through the projection of Snoke's ship and cuts it in half. And then we see how powerful she is, but she's not using this power. Why? Why is Leia not doing this? It's because Leia's true strength is in her leadership and her tactical brilliance. And we see this throughout the entire film. This wasn't the Leia-centric film. This was the Luke-centric film. At its conception, the sequel trilogy was supposed to focus on one person of the original three.
And the first one is
in
Han.
Each of the movies. So we have Han, we have Luke, and we were supposed to have Leia in Rise of the Skywalker, but we had the untimely passing of Carrie Fisher, so we couldn't do that. Leia is so powerful and so brilliant that she knows exactly what's going on. She has these plans, and that's where this connection with Poe's character comes in. Poe's character, you feel for Poe's character because you understand how much Leia sees Han in him and how much Leia wants him to rise to the potential like Han did. Poe is a very talented pilot, arguably the best pilot out there, probably since Anakin Skywalker himself. But what Poe lacks is discipline and foresight. He thinks in the beginning of this film, when he wants to take out the dreadnought, he does it at any cost. He's like, oh, it's okay. We took out like this giant fleet destroying ship. And he doesn't see the point that, yes, but they lost almost their entire bombing squad because of it. And this is where Poe's character, he's not really in The Force Awakens enough for you to connect to. So this is where we're supposed to see him. And in all honesty, because he's like one of these like main three characters, people are like, oh no, Poe's totally right. Where this entire movie is set up in a way to tell you, no, Poe's an idiot. And he is causing way more damage than if he just fell into line and followed orders.
Yeah.
And then when we have Finn and Rose who are connecting, and in this Canto Bight scene, that entire scene, a lot of it is to kind of reinforce this idea of light within dark, or like the darkness within light and the light within darkness, and this duality that the entire film is focused on. It's a very thematic sequence, and it's not so much to build these characters of Finn and Rose. And like, that is a huge critique, is that we don't really get enough of Finn and Rose here being Finn and Rose. And then we get that really bad line at the end of, I mean, it's a good line, but it's delivered in a very poor way of, but this is how we win, not fighting what we hate, but saving what we love. Yeah. And like, honestly, if that wasn't followed up by a kiss, that line's totally fine.
Yeah.
I think
forced it. So, and Kelly Marie Tran, I just think it's terrible in this movie. Like, I really do. And like, look, you go to sit down and you watch a Star Wars movie, it's not for the acting. So like, let's be real. Yeah. Like, I always loved when The Force Awakens came out, people were like, John Boyega and Daisy Ridley should be nominated for Oscars. It's like, no, they shouldn't. There's a reason why Mark Hamill never had a full acting career and it became more of a voice acting career. It's not just that he got in a car crash. It's because he's not a very good actor. Like, let's be real. Mm-hmm. Carrie Fisher, terrible actress, like legitimately a bad actress, but plays the role of Princess Leia to perfection. That's mm-hmm. all you need her to do. Harrison Ford's the best actor out of the bunch, strictly just because he's Harrison Ford. Like, he has so much charisma and so much charm that there's nothing, like, he doesn't need to be a good actor. He's just going to be likable no matter what role he plays. So the fact that I don't think Kelly Marie Tran is very good in this movie, and yeah, her line delivery, and I guess what, Solo came out the year after this?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. But at this point, I was so over Rogue One. I was so over this. And I just kind of lost faith a little bit in the Star mm-hmm. Wars world. And they became so on the nose. And they've always been on the nose. Like, I'm not trying to say like Star Wars used to be some deep Lynchian bullshit. They've always been on the nose. But I feel like Star Wars really jumped off the deep end once J.J. Abrams took over with some mm-hmm. of this like on the nose nonsense. And to me, this ending, that line is so cornball to me. And it's like, why do we need that line in there? Like, why can't it just be that like her saving him was enough? And then maybe there's no line and it's just a kiss. But also, we don't care about Rose and Finn getting together at all. Like, this isn't what's going to keep us coming back for the next movie. And what disappoints me is, and I know you're not a Force Awakens guy, I still will be. What disappoints me is I think Finn was very interesting in The Force Awakens, and I think there were some cool things they could have done with him. And I think they were like, well, crap, we have no idea what to do with him in the second movie now. And I don't think they ever saw that problem. You should
wait to see what they did with him in the third movie.
I don't even want to. Like, they just totally dropped the ball on mm-hmm. what they could have done with him.
They had a very interesting character, and they didn't realize him to his greatest potential. But I think a lot of that comes down to the fact that the best part of this movie is the Rey Kylo Ren part of this film to me. And I know you have your complaints about Snoke not being present enough, but here's the thing. Snoke is not the villain of this movie. Mm-hmm. Snoke was never intended to be the villain of this movie. This movie is about Kylo Ren. Because what we are seeing here is we're not seeing this turmoil that we saw in the original trilogy, where we had Anakin Skywalker has been evil, but he has that light still in him. The whole point of this is that Kylo Ren is evil. We're not talking about some angry kid who's been manipulated by the Dark Lord of the Sith to let his rage out all the time. We're talking about someone who has full intent and purpose to be a dictator ruling the galaxy. He is an evil person, and this fallacy that Rey has that there is light in him is supposed to be completely obliterated by the end of this film. Mm-hmm. This is supposed to be the death of Ben Solo and the emergence of Kylo Ren, supreme leader of the First Order. Mm-hmm. He is the villain. Snoke is there simply as a plot device to demonstrate him going from Ben Solo to Kylo Ren. And that decision is shown at the very beginning of this film when Snoke tells him to take that stupid helmet off. Mm-hmm. And we just get to see Adam Driver's face for the entire rest of the film. Because this is about the person. This isn't about creating an icon like Darth Vader to send mm-hmm. fear into everyone. This is about making a villain who is so strong in his conviction to do evil things mm-hmm. that we have to see his face to even remotely connect to him. Otherwise, we couldn't do it.
No, and I agree. I think that Kylo Ren in this movie is the best part by far. Mm-hmm. I think him and Daisy Ridley do so much with what they have. Like, yep. they are both so good. I love their moments together. I love the little conversations that aren't taking place in the same location. I think all that is really cool. Like, I really do. I really like that stuff a lot. However, I do not like that they still kill Snoke so early. Because I understand that Snoke isn't the villain, and it's kind of like subverting the expectation where when you go and you watch, you know, Empire, or mm-hmm. really it's in Return of the Jedi, Darth Vader finds the humanity and kills the Emperor.
Yeah.
We think we're going to get that, and he does kill Snoke, but it is to make Rey join him, not to go against him. However, I still think that Snoke, I knew nothing about. I just knew nothing about him in this to make it feel earned that Kylo Ren would kill him. And I'm supposed, like, it doesn't feel powerful enough to me because of the lack of what Snoke was really supposed to bring to the table.
I think that's kind of the huge thing about this movie, though, is that Snoke, and like what Snoke is really doing here, Snoke is just a figurehead. You didn't need to learn more about Snoke because you knew what his role was already. You knew that he was, you know from the conversations that we have throughout the film that Snoke is the one who turned Kylo Ren to the dark side, supposedly. Mm-hmm. You know he's the supreme leader of this remnants of the old empire forming the First Order. So you already have, because this is a film as part of a series and a part of a very fleshed out world, mm-hmm. we already know that Snoke is not supposed to be anything other than this epitome of evil. Mm-hmm. And based on, I started watching the prequels trilogy again today.
I saw that.
And I have, and a big part of Star Wars and the lore in Star Wars is that the Sith Lord, the most powerful Sith Lords, all kill their master at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Darth Sidious kills Darth Plagueis after he learns the powers of like extending his life and everything. And then Vader kills the Emperor when he realizes his goodness again. And in this case, what we're having is that Snoke is supposed to be this evil, but he's easily thwarted by this child, essentially, who is so much more evil than him that immediately after Snoke's dead and Hux is there and he sees him, Hux, after a moment talking to Kylo Ren at that point, is like, oh yeah, no, you're the leader of this now. I get that. And that's the beauty of this, because the whole point, again, we're going to circle back to that theme of duality, in which Kylo Ren is so evil because Rey is so good.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right? They're foils of each other. And yeah, we don't really see that until we get that there. And it's really nailing home that lesson that Luke gives about the Force is not this thing to be used. It is the balance between everything. Mm-hmm. And that is just what's so powerful about this film, is that the balance between Kylo Ren and Rey creates the Force, essentially.
Yeah.
And it is why this movie is so strong, is because of that tension between the duality of the two.
Yeah, no, I get you. I mean, again, I have no complaints with Kylo Ren and Rey. I just think, like, in a movie that was trying to subvert expectations the entire time, and it really was. I mean, it was trying mm-hmm. to make a different, like you're saying, like, not a Star Wars movie, make something different. I just think that they should have subverted them a little bit with Snoke. Snoke should have just been something more relevant to everything that was going on. Instead of like, he literally just gets cut in half and it's like, and now he's gone. And it's like, okay, that's fine. But like, whatever. Yeah. And then I don't know. I just, that's really where like those are my biggest complaints. It's just, it's the fact that Rose and Finn's storyline takes up a half hour. It's the fact that Snoke is really nothing. And then I have to say, John, it's probably pissed me off more than anything in the history of the world. And that's a lot of bad stuff. Luke Skywalker's shoulder brush, I don't know why, but it really, oh my God, man. Oh my God. I had to watch, you know, like I just think about like when Jack Black punts Baxter off the bridge in Anchorman, I'm like, I finally understand. I get it. You know what? If Baxter was there to punt him off the bridge right now, it makes me so mad. And I don't know why, but it just, it's so corny. And Luke doesn't do anything like that in any of the movies. Like, Luke doesn't do that. Like, Luke is as bad as Mark Hamill is at, you know, acting half the time, he's still like, it's a likable, whatever. And like, this little, like, I'm just like, oh man, dude, like, what, why did we have to go there? Like, that, it just makes me so mad. So those are my three big complaints. And that might be the one that actually drops it the most in my rankings, or, you know, with stars, because it just makes me so mad. And don't know why, John.
That's very understandable. It does seem like a very out of character thing. And before I move on to Luke's character, which I think is a very important part of this movie, I do want to address what the bitter juror said here about why does Kylo hesitate to kill Leia if he's so evil? That's in the first part of the movie. That is before he completely embraces his evil and goes all the way. That is because there is light in Kylo at that point, just like there's darkness in Rey at that point, where Rey goes into that darkness and Kylo is light. There is like I said, there's that theme that's shown in the Canto Bight where it's the light within the darkness and the darkness within the light. So at that point, he is still has that those remnants of Ben Solo, and he doesn't lose them until later in the film. But Luke's character, which is another one of the biggest points of contention of many people who watch this movie, people are like, what, Luke is this completely righteous hero? That's what we've seen in, he's this righteous, unfallible hero. He was young and cocky in Empire, and it almost cost him, but he came back, he took his time, and he thwarted evil in Return of the Jedi, was able to get Vader to turn back into Anakin. How could he be this nihilistic hermit who just, like, hates everything? I hate to break this to you, everyone. That's called life.
Yeah.
You are going to be more pessimistic as you get through. And what this is actual character development for Luke Skywalker, because we didn't have that before. Luke Skywalker was this prototypical hero before. And this is another part of the ingenuity, I think, of The Last Jedi, is that Rian Johnson took the hero's journey. And after the typical hero's journey, in Campbell's writing, he talks about like the latter half of the hero's journey, which is there's a return as well. Mm-hmm. And in that return, the hero has to decide between sharing the knowledge he has gained or keeping it to himself. Mm-hmm. And Rian Johnson's like, you know what, guys? Why not both? Mm-hmm. Luke shares it. And at the first instance of that going wrong and seeming like it's the wrong decision, he changes his mind and goes the exact drastic opposite way. Where he's like, I'm just going to keep this away from everyone because I was wrong. This is bad. The Jedi are bad. They suffer from hubris. And they're the reason bad things happen. They're the reason the Empire happened, was because the Jedi just were way too cocky and had no idea what was going on. Mm-hmm. So when we get into this and we see Luke broken down, it's supposed to make you feel bad. You're supposed to be like, if Luke Skywalker can get to this point of despair where he thinks it's not worth it at all, what's that mean for the rest of us? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes Rey's character and her optimism so indicative of this light inside her, because she's there. And despite Luke saying, no, listen, like, there's nothing there, we can't do anything, she's like, no, I'm going to try. I have to try. And that falls into the other theme of this movie, which is the best way to learn is through failure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, like, Luke, I honestly think, like, a lot of the criticisms of Luke in this movie are kind of, like, over the top. Like, I think, like, you start getting into a point where, like, at the end of the day, like, it's the same reason why I don't watch Marvel movies, because I would find myself nitpicking the living daylights out of them. And I think that, you know, that's kind of become something with, like, just popular culture in general, is people love to nitpick them. And that's fine. I mean, like if you want to go nitpick movies, like, you're ruining movies for yourself by nitpicking them. I mean, I do this with Citizen Kane all the time, but he died alone. Nobody was there to hear his last words. Also, what does Rosebud mean? Okay, anyway, it's not a plot hole, right? It's just the entire movie is based around something that couldn't have happened based on what everybody else has said the entire movie. But disregard, move on, we'll go to the next thing. But I do think that it's kind of unfortunate that with like super popular stuff, we've kind of just gotten to the point where it's like, let's just nitpick it really no matter what. And like Luke, Kylo, Rey, you can have your problems. Like, I'm not saying don't have problems. It's just like when it comes to like little things, every movie is going to have moments where the characters' decisions don't necessarily match up. The really great ones don't have those moments, you know, the Deer Hunter, the Godfather, things like that. But it's like most movies are going to have this moment where you're like, you just kind of got to go with it a little bit. It's the willing suspension of disbelief. You just have to, you just have to do that. That's why, like with a movie like The Last Jedi, the first time I watched it, this was like a 1-star movie to me. And it was definitely something where I felt I was nitpicking so much about it. Mm-hmm. And then I watch it this time and I'm like, it's a perfectly entertaining movie. Mm-hmm. What makes me annoyed is that, in my estimation, the Star Wars universe can create great, great, great movies. Like, this isn't Twilight, you know, where it's just like, hey, it's going to be shit no matter what. Yeah. So just enjoy the shit. This is something that could be phenomenal. And certain parts of this movie just take it away from being phenomenal for me. And that's also what's disappointing to me, is that, like, if Rose and Finn's storyline, if they could have found something to do with them that felt more relevant in the grand scheme of things, and they didn't try to force a love story between two actors who aren't very good at acting and had no chemistry at all, at least in this movie. I don't know what they're in otherwise. Maybe they're really good. But if they didn't do that, move it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. If it's explained, and like you said, like with the Leia thing, like you can explain that, but the movie doesn't explain that. And one of the biggest things when I was getting my MFA was, if it's not on the page, we don't know. And I think that right now, that's what the problem with this for me is. Like, I don't go into the lore. I don't watch the cartoons. I know I said cartoons instead of animated. I don't watch that. I've just watched the big ones. I've watched 8 of the 9 because Rise of Skywalker, I'm not going to waste my time. But I'm not going to. But it's the same reason I never watched the last Hobbit movie. But at the same time, it's like, I wish it was on the page, because if Leia goes floating back and my dad goes, what the hell is going on? I can turn to him and say, oh, it's because of what happened 10 minutes earlier. Don't you remember? Or like, what happened with this? It's just, it's too all over the place. And in this movie, there's no buildup to it. So it's like all of those things to me, they just add up to bringing this to the level that I have it at. Could it be up higher? Yeah. Is it a better movie than The Phantom Menace? Yes. Like, it is a better movie than The Phantom Menace. Like, there's no denying that. Jar Jar Binks is a travesty, and there's nothing worse in this movie than what Jar Jar Binks is. I know you actually really like Attack of the Clones. I'm not a very big fan. I would say this is probably better than Attack of the Clones. But that's the extent I would go with it. You know what I mean? And I think that there's just, I don't know. It's a good-looking movie that I think has a lot of potential, but there's just a couple things for me where I'm just like, oh, God. And I do think a big detriment to this movie for me is just that Poe does not click at all for me. Like, he just doesn't click. I don't even buy Oscar Isaac, really, as, like, an action hero. Like, I just don't buy it at all. Like, that's not who he is to me. I've seen him in too much other stuff where he's just useless. So – not useless, but, you know, he plays like kind of like a deadbeat, yes, or just like a regular person that for him to be an action hero, like, he's never going to be Han Solo. It's just not feasible. That's why, you know, look, I like this a lot more than the first time. There's no denying it. It's really not. I don't think that this movie should be as polarizing as it is. I think it should be a movie that some people find to be phenomenal and some people find to be like pretty good, okay, whatever, or meh. I don't really think that it should be as polarizing as it is. And I think it's funny, but I also think what makes things polarizing is when you have a group that really loves something, you're going to get a group that has to come back against that and really hate it. Just like if there's a group that really hates something, there has to be a group that really comes out and really loves it.
So what you're saying is this film did even more towards its theme of duality by creating those
really
who really love it and those who really hate it.
It really did. And it kind of also, I think that this was a good, you got to think, this movie came out in 2017, correct?
Yeah.
That was the first year of the Trump presidency in America, 17, 18, 19, 20. Yeah. First year of the Trump presidency in America. I always forget because we do election and then it's like, yeah, whatever. First year of the Trump, pretty dual, like it was actually pretty reminiscent of what was kind of happening in our country, in the world, whatever you want to say, with this. Some people loved them. Some people hated them. There was no in between. And unfortunately, I think that what The Last Jedi may or may not have intentionally been doing is it actually is kind of a reflection on society in way too much of a way of this duality, because there has become zero middle ground. There is no more gray area. There are no more Lando Calrissians. It just kind of is what it is, unfortunately. Everybody's either evil or great or whatever. There's a great article by The Guardian today that came out, John. I don't know if you read it or not, about how America's already in a civil war. I'm sure you would really enjoy
that. I have not read that, but it sounds very interesting. But I was going to say, but we do have a character in this film straddling the middle. And that's Benicio Del Toro's character.
Yes.
And who specifically gives us that the line of good guys, bad guys. Those are made up words. Mm-hmm. And like that is another part of that Canto Bite sequence that I feel is really important to this theme. Because the whole point of it is that we have these extremes of the light and the dark between Kylo Ren and Rey. And then we kind of have everyone in between. And everyone in between kind of falls on these different points on the scale. And Benicio Del Toro's character is pretty much our, like, he's our true neutral in this. He's out for himself. He will do whatever. He'll betray everyone right away so to make a few bucks and get off with his life. And he does it by stealing this starship. And when he has that conversation with Finn about, look, this isn't black and white. This guy sold weaponry to the First Order. Also sold it to the rebellion. Like, it goes both ways. And that is so potent to me. And it just really helps me to look and see, like, what Rian Johnson's going for in this film. And I get it. Rian Johnson's also a very polarizing director in general. The fact that he was pulled on to do this movie in the first place is baffling. I mean, obviously, much better pick than J.J. Abrams, but that's because J.J. Abrams kind of ruins everything he touches.
I almost got in trouble with one of my friends because you said J.J. Abrams and Lindelof, and he thought that you were insulting Lindelof, and he was like, "How you?"
I would never.
That I'm like, no, he loves Lindelof. Insult Lindelof. Like, I'm not worried about him insulting Lindelof. I knew where you stood on that. Don't worry.
But Rian Johnson, I mean, even if we look at so Rian Johnson directed one of the greatest hours of television in Ozymandias. Mm-hmm. And then also one of the most polarizing episodes of Breaking Bad and The Fly.
The Fly is terrible. I don't care what anybody says.
No, that episode is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, John, don't lose your credibility.
Discussion for a different day. But to have him come in, I mean, part of it came off of the fact that he just made Looper and like was very much praised for that movie. Mm-hmm. But what he brought to... what he was really bringing to the Star Wars universe was hope, which is the central theme of every Star Wars movie. And we get it at the tail end of this film where the boy is sweeping broom guy. I just noticed for the first time, for some reason on this rewatch, and I've watched this movie probably more than most people have watched this movie, that this kid uses the Force to grab that broom at the end of the movie. Mm-hmm. Don't know why I missed that before, but like, it's that hope. It's that hope of what the resistance starts. It's probably one of the stupidest lines in the entire movie about the resistance being the spark that will ignite the flame that will burn the First Order down. It's one of the most convoluted metaphors of all time. But that's really what this movie is about, is that hope. And Rian Johnson gave that to us. He provided an opportunity for Star Wars to be more than just this science fantasy film that follows a very predictable journey. And he gave Star Wars the opportunity to explore depth the way that Star Wars was exploring depth in the animated series. Like, if anyone really likes Star Wars and they just want to watch an animated series, watch The Clone Wars, because it goes from this pretty unbearable children's show into one of the greatest character studies that this universe could ever produce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I'll say, John, you got like five more minutes because I'm going to bed. But I do think one of the big problems with Rian Johnson is that he definitely has a massive ego.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's hurt him because I personally, I think his four movies or three of his four movies are great. Like Brick, I love. I think Brick is such a great neo-noir. Looper, I think, is a very entertaining movie. And I think Knives Out is a very entertaining movie. Like, I think he makes very entertaining movies. Ozymandias. That's just one of the best episodes of TV ever. And I'm not even a big Breaking Bad fan, but I think when he got the critique on The Fly, it's almost like he didn't know how to handle that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like that kind of turned people off from him, where his ego is just so big. And, you know, they almost want to look for things that are wrong with his movies. I will say though, I want to go back to the point you made. And I think it is very relevant to regular society and, you know, whether it's the intention or not, whatever. But you were talking about how with Benicio del Toro's character, he sells to the resistance. He also sells to the First Order. I always love in a country like America, where it's a capitalist society, how you'll have a business that will come out and blatantly support one political candidate over another. And then people, I'm going to boycott. At the end of the day, they're going to serve you food. Like if you're In-N-Out Burger, which has supported Republicans since like the dawn of time, every time they would come out and support Trump or another Republican candidate, everybody in California would say, we're not going to go to In-N-Out ever again. The line for In-N-Out would still be 70 cars long. Because at the end of the day, wherever you go to eat in America, which now with the vaccine cards is kind of changing things a little bit in certain parts of the country. But nobody's going to ask you, oh, well, who'd you vote for? Okay, well, you voted. We're not going to feed you then. We're not going to give you food. Like that's not what happens. That's just not something that happens. You see people trying to do that every now and then. They get their 5 seconds of fame, and then nobody cares about them anymore. But this movie is kind of also addressing that of like, it doesn't matter. Money is going to be money to the people who need the money. And, you know, an arms dealer isn't exactly caring about the morality of everything. It is what it is. They just want to make their money, just like these businesses in a capitalist society want to make their money. If you're going to give people the opportunity, they're going to look to make their money. They're going to say what they think is going to get them to where they need to go. But ultimately, they're going to look out for number one, which is them. I think it's a very interesting little dynamic there that's going on between Benicio del Toro's character and a lot of what you see in a country that's as divided as America is right now.
Yeah. I mean, there are a couple. It's great that Rian Johnson kind of brought in that political commentary, because that is something that Star Wars has avoided for the most part, despite the fact that the prequel trilogy is really just three political thrillers, somehow still managed to avoid bringing in real politics into the films. And Rian Johnson, this is why this is probably the best movie of the Star Wars movies. Like I said, it might not be for most people, it's not the best Star Wars movie, but it's the best movie set in the Star Wars universe by the way that it's approached.
And another thing, too, is it's definitely more subtle with its stuff. I always go back to the Solo thing, anything you want from the bar, equal rights and whatever. And I'm just like, yo, like, get out of here. Like, go away. Like, that is so lazy. It's so lazy and so, like, aren't we great? We're Disney. We care about stuff. Like, look at us. We're in tune. It's like, go make your billions. My bad. Go make your billions and leave me the F alone. Like, get out of here. It's so ridiculous. Like, this is subtle. I can get behind subtle. Subtle is my friend.
Mm-hmm.
That type of shit. So, get out of here. Continue, John. You have like 2 minutes.
Before we wrap up, there are a few things I really want to touch on that we haven't touched on yet. First off, Laura Dern's phenomenal in this film. Laura Dern's phenomenal in almost everything she's in. But the character of Holdo and the fact that she's, again, I really like the fact that Star Wars really focuses on these strong female leaders for the rebellion and the resistance. And Holdo, we have the fact that Holdo's reputation precedes her, and Poe's clearly surprised that she's a woman. Mm-hmm. And it's good to have that reminder there that, like, these people are out there and they're doing these things, and you have these preconceived notions of them. And because you're this arrogant flyboy who thinks he knows what's best for everything, and you want to go behind her back to make this plan that's their only chance for escape, when she's come up with probably the highest rate of success that anything's happened. Holdo is not a terrible captain. Holdo understands the whole idea of the chain of command. Holdo's in charge. Poe has been demoted at this point. He has no right to be demanding to know the plan. Mm-hmm. And because the only reason people dislike Holdo is because you're supposed to like Poe. Mm-hmm. But when you really get into the film and you realize you're not supposed to like Poe's decisions for the majority of this film until we get to Crait at the end, that's when you kind of realize, oh, wait, Holdo's actually very, very good at what, like, she's vice admiral for a reason. You don't get to that point in a military institution unless it's well-deserved. Mm-hmm. Snoke Chambers, modeled after the Black Launch.
Yeah, I know. I always love that. Very interesting. And it's very noticeable. Very
obvious. It is. It's very noticeable. And then you have the sequence on Crait. It's weird. Why is there the salt and everything? And I love the fact that they put the salt and the red earth there just to show the fact that, like, during the Kylo Ren Luke fight, Kylo's making all these footprints and Luke's not. It's just a small detail you're supposed to pick up on to realize that Luke's not actually there. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Also, the fact that he's using the lightsaber that just got broken in half.
Yeah, that's kind of like the biggest one.
Yeah. But other things, like, Johnson even approaches the fact that the bombers at the beginning, if you watch the beginning sequence where, and this is another critique that Poe's, like, banter with Hux is ridiculous and not something a Star Wars character would do. Whatever. It's humorous. It's stalling. And then we have the bombers approach, and we see how much slower the bombers are. It's just, like, those little details where it's like, why would a bomber need to go slow in space? Oh, yeah, it's so it doesn't dislodge its load and blow itself up. This is the detail that Johnson put into everything.
That you're not necessarily seeing in the earlier Star Wars, where it's kind of just like, hey, you'll assume that it's, you know.
Exactly.
We'll just take our liberties. Yeah.
Yep. And I think that's everything I want to get down to.
Good.
Oh, no, there's one more thing, and it's the end scene where Luke is dying, and we get that binary sunset shot. That is just this love letter to Star Wars. And it really goes to show that Rian Johnson is actually a Star Wars fan making this movie.
Yeah, that is, you know, definitely a Star Wars-esque ending for a massive Star Wars guy. Is he in The Rise of Skywalker at all or no?
Who?
Mark Hamill?
No.
Okay, I was just wondering. Maybe. I wasn't sure. I don't know, because Yoda makes, like, his 2 seconds.
I've seen that movie twice. It was within 24 hours because I went a second time to make sure it was as bad as I thought it was.
Yeah, yeah. And it was.
So I haven't watched it since.
Well, I'm not going to say I'm going to run out and watch The Last Jedi again anytime soon, John. But hey, it was better than the first time. And at least you turned me from being like one of those people who just literally sits here and shits on it. So, but next week, we're going to be coming back with our number 53. This is the longest podcast we've done in this series because I really let John run. All right, next week we're coming back with number 53, where we are going to talk about Parasite, which John had just one spot higher than I did. My number 53 is Almost Famous, but John has that much higher. So we're going to be talking about The Last Days of Disco. If you didn't like Barcelona, you're probably not going to like The Last Days of Disco. It's another Whit Stillman movie. It's really dialogue heavy. The setting doesn't seem realistic at all. At least in Barcelona, it looks a lot more, you know, ready. The Last Days of Disco is a very interesting movie. I am a massive fan of it. Kate Beckinsale and Chloe Savini. But I'm excited to see what you think of it, John. Ultimately, it's Whit Stillman, so it's going to be dialogue heavy. And yeah, that should be a fun conversation. It's all about music, which Almost Famous is as well. We'll see you all next time. Thanks for listening. Go check out our 2021 year in review, where we didn't watch half the movies from 2021. And, you know, we'll be doing some Oscar stuff coming up. So see everybody next week.